You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass Politics is sponsored by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. That's Fiverr with two R's. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100 categories all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can imagine, all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. And right now, if you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And before we start the show, I want to ask for you, the listeners, help with a special project. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be doing a listener survey to get a better idea of who our audience is. No matter how long you've been a listener or how frequently you listen to the show, we'd like to get to know you better and what you want. So I hope you'll visit our website at kickasspolitics.com and click on the listener survey link on the homepage, or there's a survey link in the show notes to this episode. It's just a few quick questions to help us understand who's listening, and seriously, it'll be a huge, huge help to me personally. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page and Twitter to tell your friends to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my recent guests. This week, I'm giving away a copy of Jack Kemp, The Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America, signed by my guests Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki from Fox News' The Beltway Boys. To be entered to win, just go on Twitter or Facebook and recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends. Be sure to include a link to the show on iTunes so they can subscribe, and don't forget to tag us in your posts so we know you participated and we can include you in the drawing. And hey, if you want to double your chances of winning, then promote the show on both Facebook and Twitter. In fact, you'll be entered to win for every time that you recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on your social media. Just help me gain some new listeners, and you'll have a shot at winning a cool prize every week. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. My guests today are Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki. Fred Barnes is the co-founder and executive editor of The Weekly Standard, and Mort Kondracki served as the executive editor of Roll Call and former Washington bureau chief for Newsweek. But you probably know them best as the Beltway Boys. That's the name of the popular weekly political program that they co-hosted for over 10 years on Fox News. Today, they still regularly appear as political commentators on Fox News, and they recently teamed up to write the first ever biography exploring the legacy of the late congressman, quarterback, and self-proclaimed bleeding heart conservative, Jack Kemp. According to them, Jack Kemp may well have been the most important American politician who never made it to the White House. And in their words, he's a model of how politics ought to be. Today we'll talk about how Jack Kemp's pro football career influenced his leadership style, and how he became the backbone behind President Ronald Reagan's economic policy. We'll talk about his crusade to help America's underprivileged and bring African Americans back to the party of Lincoln. Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki will also explain why the next Speaker of the House may be the natural political heir to Jack Kemp. Plus, they'll talk about Kemp on Trump, the turn in Jeb Bush's political fortunes, and what to look for in tonight's third Republican debate. All that coming up with the Beltway Boys, Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki, in just a moment.
Hey Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Folks, it doesn't get more inside the Beltway than these two. Today, my guests are Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki. But if you watch Fox News, then you know them as the Beltway Boys. Mort Kondracki served as the executive editor of the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and Washington bureau chief for Newsweek. And Fred Barnes is the executive editor of the Weekly Standard, which he co-founded with Bill Kristol. And they have a wonderful new book called Jack Kemp, The Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. Guys, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
I got to tell you, I really love this book. As you can probably tell by the dog-eared pages, I'm about halfway through my second read of it. This is the first biography ever written about Jack Kemp. You guys say in the book that Jack Kemp was the most important politician who was never elected president. Why is that?
Well, you have to look back to the 1970s. What Jack Kemp did was to be the leading and first political advocate, evangelist, really, for supply-side economics, which was the theory that if you lowered individual tax rates and you also instituted a stable money supply, that the economy would grow, everybody would be richer, rising tide would lift all boats. So he got converted to this by Jude Winiski of the Wall Street Journal in 1976. He introduced a bill in 1977. It never passed Congress, but he finally convinced the Republican Party in general and then Ronald Reagan to adopt this this plan. And when Ronald Reagan adopted it and then followed it up with tax reform in 1986, which Kemp also pioneered, prosperity boomed. We had 20 years of prosperity after a decade of stagflation in the 1970s. So that's why we say that he was the most important Republican who never became president.
Well, one thing that comes up in the book, and I think a lot of people forget, is just how awful the era of stagflation in the 70s was. My generation has no inkling of what that was. And you talk about how clueless the government and even most economists were as to what to do about it. So for those who don't know what supply-side economics is, what is it and how did it start to gain traction over the first decade of Kemp's career in Congress?
Well, it was Kemp it gained traction just because Kemp was so relentless in being an evangelist for it. And what it does is it says we should have a relatively loose fiscal policy, in other words, deep tax cuts, and a tight monetary policy, which means the how big the Federal Reserve is going to make the money supply, just the opposite of what all the liberal and Keynesian economists have said in the 1970s. They didn't have a clue of what they could do, because in the 70s it was so bad because you had high unemployment and high inflation at the same time, and they basically threw up their hands and said, "We don't have an answer here." Jack Kemp had an answer. It was supply-side economics with these tax cuts, which, remember, it was a 30% across-the-board cut in income tax rates at every level. It was a huge tax cut, and Kemp, sold it to Republican National Chairman Bill Brock, and then more crucially, of course, sold it to Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan was always for tax cuts, but not this particular tax cuts, which maximized incentives and maximized economic growth. And those were the things that Kemp self-taught in economics. Remember, he was a football player.
Right.
And he majored in phys ed in college and yet had this remarkable career, built the supply-side movement, as Mort said, recruited Ronald Reagan, and it was successful. The rest is history.
Well, let me go back to what the 1970s were like. Largely because Lyndon Johnson inflated the economy by trying to run a war in Vietnam and a Great Society program, which were unpaid for. The inflation rate and there were oil problems as well. But anyway, the inflation rate went up to 13.5% a year. Your prices for everything were rising at 13.5% a year, and unemployment went up to like 7%. So, you know, it was if workers wanted to get a raise, in order to keep up with the prices that they were having to pay for things, their raises would be eaten away because they would be moved into higher and higher tax brackets. The top tax rate in 1980 was 70% of your income. That's for, you know, and that you got there at $200,000 a year. So, and if you were a middle income person making $35,000 a year, you paid a 37% tax rate, which is the top rate nowadays. So, so Kemp brought everything down, eventually brought the top rate down to 28%.
Yeah. And it's interesting because another thing that I don't think many people remember is there was a time when Republicans really weren't about tax cuts. This was kind of an original idea for him. It was all about austerity, cutting programs, slashing government, which still is part of the agenda.
Yeah.
But it was kind of an original idea to start lowering taxes. How did Jack Kemp go about selling his fellow congressmen and everyone in government on that kind of idea?
Well, nobody else had a good idea. And Jack Kemp had a good idea, and it was a big idea. And you're absolutely right. He transformed the Republican Party. It was the Republican Party prior to Kemp of spending cuts and austerity. He turned it into the party of tax cuts and economic growth. Completely different. Just by the strength of his personality, and he was a dynamic figure. Remember, he'd been a pro football player in the American Football League, and he was pugnacious and never gave up. Recruited all the young new Republican congressmen like Newt Gingrich in the 70s, right, as acolytes, and they carried the day. Nobody had an alternative idea as strong as Kemp's. And once Reagan adopted it and it was enacted and it succeeded, that's why we wrote the book about Kemp. That's how we changed America.
Yeah, you know, Newt Gingrich said that the politician or the historical figure that Kemp most reminded him of was Teddy Roosevelt. And I guess everybody has an image of Teddy Roosevelt as being a house of fire who grabbed you by the lapels and or the shoulders and shook you. Well, that's the kind of guy Kemp was. I mean, people, there was a joke about Kemp that somebody told that so Kemp gets captured by the Gestapo, and the Gestapo guy says, "We have ways of making you stop talking," you know, because he was so ebullient and so energetic that, sometimes he overwhelmed people.
Mm-hmm. He was looking for, rather than seeing other Democrats and other Republicans and people in the press as critics or opponents or everything, he saw them all as potential converts. And he converted many of them, no question about it.
Yeah, and there were a lot of qualities about him that were similar to Reagan.
Yeah,
the optimism, the shining city on a hill kind of idea, his own version of that, and so forth. He had quite a campaign to win over Reagan leading up to the 1980 election, and even after the 1980 election, he was still trying to sell Reagan on supply side economics. Initially, how much of Reagan's gradual conversion to supply side economics was, prior to 1980, a politically calculated move to stall Jack Kemp for running for president
That was part of it. You know, some people who worked for Kemp, like John Sears, who was his campaign manager initially, said, "Oh, we weren't worried about Kemp." Everybody else in the Reagan camp was worried about Kemp because there were people who were encouraging Kemp to run in 1980. And while Reagan probably would have won anyway, Jack Kemp would have been a significant challenger. But he wasn't. He threw in once Reagan agreed to these tax cuts, these supply-side tax cuts, 30% across the board, Kemp signed on and was a part of the Reagan team. But there was worry about that. And, of course, Reagan, one of the smart things about Reagan, he realized that these tax cuts, he may have had some doubts about them, but he realized it was a big idea and he needed one in his campaign.
Yeah, and there's a great story about Art Laffer and Kemp's advisor, Jude Waninsky, coming up with a scheme for Jack to, I hate to say it, but basically extort his way onto the ticket in 1980 in a meeting with Reagan during a visit to California. And I think how Kemp handled that idea says a lot about his character. Could one of you talk about what happened during that meeting with Reagan?
So the idea was going to be that there was a dinner party at Laffer's house, and Arthur Laffer was a famous economist who who was the author of the Laffer Curve,
right,
which we can get into. But in any event, so he has Reagan and a bunch of Reaganites over to his house for dinner with Jack Kemp. And the plot was that Reagan and Kemp would go off into this guest house, and Kemp would propose the following: that Kemp would run for president along with Reagan, but at the convention, Kemp would drop out and tell his delegates, instruct his delegates to support Reagan. So the implication of this, although not part of what Kemp was going to tell Reagan, was that he would then get picked up as vice president. When they got to the guest house, as a matter of fact, shrewdly, somebody from I think it was John Sears, actually, had arranged for Kemp and Joanne Kemp, his wife, to have lunch with the Reagans that very day. And Kemp grilled Reagan about what he thought about supply-side economics, and he was totally satisfied with what Reagan said, that he understood what it was all about. So when they got to the guest house, instead of unfolding the plot, he said he pledged his full support and said, Ron, I would never run against you. You're my hero, blah, blah, blah. And then he comes back and tells Laffer about this, and Laffer blew up and said, Jack, you've just given up the vice presidency. And indeed he had. I don't think there was much chance that he would had been selected anyway, because what Reagan needed was George Bush. But nonetheless, it blew up.
It was a crazy plot. Never would have worked anyway. Right, yeah. It was too cute.
Well, yeah. And,
typical Winiski, I might add.
Yeah. And it does show how uncynical Jack Kemp was, mm-hmm, as a politician, mm-hmm, and how he was, mm-hmm, throughout his career. I keep seeing this, mm-hmm, theme of him passing up his own political opportunity, mm-hmm, passing up running for Senate and so forth, because he was all about the policy. He was all about, mm-hmm, whatever was best for championing his policy of supply side economics.
Yeah, and his idea of politics was that you prevail as a party when you have better ideas. You don't just prevail because you're exploiting a scandal or something. Kemp wasn't interested in that. He really didn't care whether Republicans controlled the House of Representatives or not. He cared whether his ideas were prevailing.
Yeah, he didn't seem to have a mean bone in his body. He was not a negative campaigner. He, mm-hmm, never made personal attacks.
Right.
It's almost surprising that he made it as far as he did in the political world.
Well, he was a dynamic figure and someone who was relentless and seeking converts everywhere. And he had this dazzling personality that had a big impact on people, and a favorable one.
In winning over converts, like I alluded to earlier, even after the election of 1980, he was still trying to win over Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm, and there was a lot of infighting, mm-hmm, in the administration over supply-side economics, a lot of doubts. It was a tough fight for a number of years. Definitely there were some frayed nerves there.
Absolutely.
And some strained relations there. Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan had a love-hate relationship, or how would you characterize that?
Well, it was more love than hate, but Kemp was a man of conviction. And Reagan was more of a pragmatist, more of a compromiser than Kemp wanted him to be. And Kemp thought, quite correctly, that Reagan was surrounded in the White House by Bushies, by people who were George H.W. Bush campaign aides. Jim Baker was the chief of staff. He'd been George H.W. Bush's campaign manager. David Stockman, who was thought to have been a supply-sider, the budget director, turned out to be a budget balancer and a tax raiser. And there was a whole slew of them in the White House who were constantly trying to raise taxes after Reagan had cut them. And some of the tax increases were legitimate because Congress had stuffed the tax code with all kinds of crazy breaks in the 1981 bill. And some of them needed to be repealed. But this was the midst of a recession caused by Paul Volcker, who crushed inflation by raising interest rates to the max. A mortgage was the interest payments on a mortgage were 20% a year.
Yeah.
So nobody bought anything, right? And so inflation got crushed out of the economy. So Kemp thought, in a recession, the last thing you do is raise any taxes. So he was always opposed to what Reagan was proposing, and Reagan called him unreasonable, and he got brought to the White House for chewing out sessions. And the worst of it was that Baker and company leaked these stories to the press about how Kemp was putting his own political fortune against his loyalty to Reagan. And Kemp at that point was the number three leader of House Republicans. So that made him even more vulnerable to attack because he wasn't following the leader.
Yeah, the important thing is Reagan didn't flinch on the supply side tax cuts. As it turned out, it was 25% across the board. That's what was passed by Congress. And while all these aides at the White House were urging Reagan to raise taxes and to back off from supply side tax cuts, he never did. And Kemp was part of the reason because if Reagan had, Kemp would have been all over him.
His other great passion was helping the underprivileged, but helping them through conservative principles mm-hmm. of lifting people up, very much a similar philosophy mm-hmm. to Abraham Lincoln, who mm-hmm. was, I think, his personal hero. And he was a civil rights champion and constantly talked about returning the GOP to the party of Lincoln at a time when that wasn't terribly popular. This was following the infamous Southern strategy. And there's a great story in the book about two trips that he made to Texas way back when he was playing for the American Football League and how those shaped his views on race and inspired him to take up that cause. Mort, yeah. Can you tell those stories?
Yeah. So he was playing for the San Diego Chargers and Sid Gillman was the coach. And so they went to this movie theater in Houston, and all of a sudden Kemp looks around and he sees that all the black players are required to sit up in the balcony where the white players get to sit down below. And he said to Sid Gillman, that's not fair. And Sid Gillman said, you're absolutely right. And the whole team walked out. Then the other incident, which occurred actually in New Orleans, was 1965, January of 65, was the American Football League All-Star Game. It was the Buffalo Bills against the All-Stars of the rest of the league. And the game was scheduled to be in New Orleans. And the black players were not allowed to go to restaurants, they had to go into blacks only taxi cabs, white cabs wouldn't take them. And so the black players decided to boycott the game. And Kemp was the president of the American Football League Players Association, the union, and he stood with them, and they succeeded in moving the game to Houston and, embarrassed the heck out of New Orleans and helped advance the cause of integration in New Orleans.
And the black players just love Kemp. When Kemp died in 2009 and Cookie Gilchrist, the great African-American running back for the Buffalo Bills, heard about it, he wept.
Wow. Yeah, and there's a great story in there. I think it was in Dallas where the black players were put up somewhere way out in the middle of nowhere. Right. And the white players were put up in a Hilton hotel. The team was owned by Baron Hilton. Yeah. And Kemp says to, I think you'll have to remind me, he says to the coach something to the extent of, either we're all staying here or none of us are staying here. And, ended up with the whole team being stuck out in the middle of nowhere in some flea bag.
It was in some college dorm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the team stuck together, and it was Kemp who had them stick together.
Well, one of my other favorite stories is that, leading up to the 88 campaign, Trent Lott invites Kemp to go down to Mississippi and for a fundraiser. And Lott says, Jack, I love you, but please don't talk about Abraham Lincoln. Don't talk about how blacks should be back in the Republican Party. Just talk about growth and all that kind of stuff. So Jack goes to this fundraiser, and the first thing he starts talking about is how we need more blacks in the Republican Party and how we're the party of Abraham Lincoln. He was incorrigible.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he did seem to have this kind of twinkle in his eye whenever someone told him not to do something.
Yep.
And in the book, you also talk about how he was kind of a difficult guy mm-hmm. to deal with sometimes. He was apparently a horrible driver and a backseat driver when he wasn't mm-hmm. in the behind mm-hmm. the wheel.
Jack was very impatient.
Yeah, and drove his staffers crazy, sometimes pitted them against each other, wasn't great about apologizing, often chewed them out. Mm-hmm. But when you talk to people who worked for Kemp, and I remember when Jack Kemp passed away about a year or two ago, I had a few friends who had worked with him on his congressional staff, and it was as if their own father had died. The loyalty that people who knew him had to Jack Kemp was just stunning to me. What was it about Jack Kemp that just made you want to follow him to the last front?
Well, I mean, part of it was that they knew that he had grand causes. And you mentioned, you know, it was all about growth. I mean, he borrowed a lot of what he thought from John F. Kennedy. A rising tide lifts all boats. Then he was convinced by actually Vernon Jordan of the Urban League that some boats are stuck on the bottom and have need government help to lift them. But, you know, so they knew that he was an idealist and an optimist. And when he barked at them, it was all over in seconds. I mean, he never held a grudge against anybody, never, you know, he would chew them out, have a flare up, and then he would sort of skulk up to them and say, "You okay? Are you all right? Is everything okay?" You know, and so there was no enmity in the staff.
You know, Jack Kemp was never a careerist. It was the ideas that mattered. You know, when he was a powerful and influential figure in the 1970s, culminating with the tax cuts in 1981, he was not a member of the Ways and Means Committee in the House, which is the tax writing committee. He held no position. He wasn't in the leadership. He was just a guy with a very big idea and with a following that he developed and then brought in Ronald Reagan. So there was, you know, he was not a calculating guy who was trying to get a position. As you noted, he didn't run for the Senate in 1980. He could have run for governor of New York. Didn't run against Reagan for the Republican nomination in 1980. Ideas mattered. His career didn't.
Well, yeah, and he finally did run for president in 1988 after Reagan, but he didn't get very far. He ended up finishing third in the GOP primary, I think.
You would not want to have been one of Kemp's handlers because he didn't he didn't take to handling well. I mean, he talked in 1988 about the need for the gold standard to be revived. Right. That was not a gripping issue in Iowa or in the New Hampshire primary, yet Jack believed in it, and that's what he talked about.
Yeah, and well, you also, I think in the book you said somewhere he was and would be against farm subsidies.
Exactly.
That would have doomed him
there.
Does
not sell in Iowa very well. But that, you know, but that's another kind of idea. He, you know, corporate welfare, and he and Trent Lott actually once wrote a letter when David Stockman was trying to raise gasoline taxes, tobacco taxes, and liquor taxes. You know, why is it, David, that you are willing to raise taxes on poor people, but you're not willing to cut subsidies for Exxon and Boeing and Gulf Oil? So he was a populist in that sense.
Bush got elected, and he didn't have much of a shot in 1988. Bush eventually brought him into his administration and made him HUD secretary. He saw this as an opportunity, perhaps, to finally put forth his deeply held philosophy of lifting people up, creating opportunity, and put that in practice. What went wrong there?
Well, it was the Bush White House that didn't like Jack Kemp's ideas, and Kemp pushed them very hard. There were ideas like the one that Margaret Thatcher implemented in England when she was prime minister, and that is to allow the people who lived in public housing to buy their units, to buy their housing. They didn't want to back that, and enterprise zones and school choice and so many of these basically conservative ideas the Bush White House was not interested in. And then, of course, Kemp was not a guy to stick just to the issues that belong to a housing and urban development secretary. He dabbled in foreign policy. He thought Ronald Reagan was not quite opposed to the Soviets as strongly as he should be, demanded that Reagan fire his Secretary of State and so on, and none of that went over well in the White House.
Yeah, he didn't really stick to his wheelhouse.
No. Right. Or as it was, the line was, he had his fork in everybody else's plate.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk about where Kemp might fit in today, and we'll take a look at the third Republican debate coming up Wednesday night. Back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki, then check out their new book, Jack Kemp, the bleeding heart conservative who changed America. And right now you can download the audio version of Jack Kemp for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Jack Kemp by my guest today, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and interesting programs in the future. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. And now, back to the show. And we're back, and I'm talking with Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki about their new book, Jack Kemp, The Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. After Bush 41 lost to Clinton, Kemp went through a few lonely years there, and by 1996, no one was really floating his name for the nomination. Senator Bob Dole, of course, won the nomination and chose Kemp as his running mate. Now, those two did not get along very well throughout most of their political career. What was the calculus behind Dole's decision to pluck Kemp from the political wilderness at that moment and put him on the ticket?
Yeah, well, Scott Reed was Dole's campaign manager and had been chief of staff for Kemp at HUD. And so he was the real go-between. But so they did polls on a whole bunch of younger, promising, you know, governors and senators and stuff like that as to who would help the ticket. And none of them lit any fires. I mean, it was going to be a hard road to hoe for Dole anyway against Clinton because prosperity and peace was reigning in the country. The public was satisfied with the way things were going. So somehow Dole had to get some excitement going. And the only person who could bring the excitement was, as Dole would call him, the quarterback. You know, and he called him the quarterback, not out of any great respect, and was sort of meant that jock, you know, because they had been rivals over policy for years and years and years. But, you know, Dole saw the wisdom of exciting the convention. And indeed, Kemp's nomination did excite the convention and Scott Reed says that it was probably the best week that Dole had during the entire campaign was the week of the convention when Kemp was nominated.
There was a problem, though, and the problem was Kemp did not want to play the traditional role of a vice presidential running mate, and that is to attack the presidential candidate of the other party.
Right.
Jack didn't attack. And, of course, famously in his debate with Al Gore, in the vice presidential debate, he did not, he from the very beginning, announced that he and Bob Dole didn't want to run an attack campaign against Bill Clinton, who was the incumbent president. And, you know, when Bob Dole was watching it, you know, he said, what is the quarterback doing? It was Jack just did not fill the traditional vice presidential role.
And Clinton was vulnerable. I mean, you know, there were just a lot of political scandals. This was pre-Monica Lewinsky. But, you know, the L.A. Times actually reported that the Democratic National Committee was collecting money and Al Gore was helping to raise it from Indonesia, from China. Buddhist monks in L.A. were you know, making contributions, poor, who, you know, were dedicated to poverty. They were obviously fronting for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And all this was in the press. And, you know, so it was perfectly legitimate for Kemp to have gone after Al Gore and Bill Clinton. But he said, the first question at the debate was, so what about, in effect, what about Clinton's ethics? And and Kemp said, we do not consider our opponents to be our enemies. They are our adversaries. And we will not stoop to the depths of negative campaigning. And as Fred says, it just drove Bob Dole crazy.
Well, yeah, you're right, and that is pretty much the biggest job of a running mate, mm-hmm. is to be the guy who takes all the flack and goes after them. And you know, he was the happy warrior who didn't mm-hmm. ever want to make any personal attacks. Mm-hmm. And these were issues, like you said, that were fair game. Mm-hmm. I in my mind, I have this image of, you know, toward the end of the election, Bob Dole just shaking him and saying, "You had one job to do."
Well, you know, the way it's been explained to me is that, when Scott Reed first proposed to Jack that he be the vice president, he turned it down. And he turned it down because he didn't want to be the attack dog. So then he was assured by Dole and by Scott Reed that he wouldn't have to be the attack dog. So, you know, then all this scandal stuff came up, and Scott Reed went down before the debate and said to Kemp, you don't have to overdo it. Just do what Dole has said. But he wouldn't even do that. I mean, Dole had started criticizing Clinton a little bit, and Kemp wouldn't even go that far.
Well, yeah, he didn't take instruction very well. Well, in reading the book, I found myself trying to imagine where Jack Kemp would fit in if he were a Republican in Congress today. So I have somewhat mixed ideas about it, I guess. I don't think he would take to the negativity, for sure, and the partisanship, and certainly the cannibalization of other conservatives by conservatives. Yet, on the other hand, I do see on certain issues where he was very passionate and intractable, and his insistence on ideological purity on certain key issues to him that kind of remind me of the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus mm-hmm. in the House. How do you think that he would fit in today?
Well, he'd have a hard time. Hard to imagine Jack Kemp as a committee chairman. You know, holding hearings and gradually bringing legislation through the committee and then passing it or not. And he and a guy to sit in a chair a lot. Jack was a live wire. He's not some guy that could actually do that job. I think he would be a breath of fresh air if he were in the Republican presidential debates. For one thing, he would be appalled at Donald Trump. I think he might have liked Donald Trump's tax reform plan, but other than that, yeah. Trump's attacks on Mexicans and on other candidates and all the indignities that Donald Trump was imposing on the entire Republican presidential race, Jack just wouldn't agree with that at all, and particularly the issue that's come up in the Republican presidential race, and that is opposition to immigration. Some of the candidates now right. say we have to cut back on legal immigration as well as stop illegal immigration. Jack was for sweeping immigration reform that would allow people who'd come here illegally, if they had clean records, to work for becoming legalized members of American society. He would have clashed with the other candidates on that issue.
Yeah. So the closest heir to Jack Kemp is Paul Ryan, and Paul Ryan actually worked, now, you know, soon to be, I hope, Speaker yeah. of the House. And as a matter of fact, he is hired as his chief of staff, Kemp's former chief of staff, Dave Hoppe. So the gang is sort of back together again. And Ryan is an idea person. I mean, he has sort of been forced into this role as speaker against his will. He was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, where he was going to be able to put his ideas for tax reform, which are Kempian, into effect. And I think Paul Ryan actually has the soul of Jack Kemp too. He doesn't have the charisma of Jack Kemp, but he cares about ordinary people and cares about poor people and wants to, you know, has the yeah. same basic, optimistic ideology that, that Kemp had.
Well, hopefully by the end of the week, we're going to have a new speaker. Do you think that Paul Ryan has those votes lined up?
It looks like he does, because there's really no alternative. There's nobody who could even come close to uniting the Republican Party, which it needs in Congress, because we see Democrats are really pretty united, so they can carry out filibusters in the Senate. And, of course, President Obama says he'll veto practically everything that Republicans might like. So they need a uniter, and that, I think, is Paul Ryan's role.
Yeah, and you know, by the time this airs, it'll be Wednesday, the day of the third Republican debate. What do you think we should be looking for in that debate?
Well, one person who in line with a lot of Kemp's ideas is Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida and, of course, a member of the Bush family. And his campaign has been dwindling now that he's in fourth or fifth place in polls. I think we need to look for Jeb Bush to step out in a bold and energetic way that we haven't seen from him before, or his campaign's just going to collapse.
Well, yeah, and he did kind of have that meltdown just a couple of days ago where he said he wasn't quite the happy warrior that he said he wasn't campaigning joyfully.
Yeah, like that's for sure.
He does have the Kemp spirit, but he doesn't have the Kemp enthusiasm or the Kemp charisma or the Kemp energy, and he's got to break through somehow, or he may as well quit, even though he's got all this money. I guess his strategy has been that that eventually the party will, you know, wandering through the wilderness with Trump and Carson and everyone else, will find itself coming back to him. But boy, he's got to give his supporters something to hang their hats on, hang their hearts on, or else he's going to dwindle into nothing.
Well, yeah, pundits keep reassuring us that when the fall leaves start to come out, that this romance with Trump is going to start to wane and Republican voters are going to finally get serious. Are we finally at that point, do you think?
No, I don't think so. it may be the leaves are one thing, but voters are something else. That's when things really change, when you're out campaigning, not just saying whatever you want, but when you have to appeal to actual voters who are going to vote in a week or two, and, you know, starting with the Iowa caucus on February 1, and then the New Hampshire primary, and then the South Carolina primary, and then you get a March 1, you get a big, 10 primary. So that's when things change. It'll be and the race, people start dropping out, and it usually winds up being a one-on-one race. You have the outside candidate, right, that'd be Trump, and then you have the mainstream candidate, who would be Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or John Kasich or somebody like that. Now, we're a long ways from that, but I think we'll wind up with that next year.
Are there any candidates that this is going to be a make-or-break debate for at this point?
I don't think it's necessarily make-or-break for Bush. If he doesn't step up, it's just going to be a further diminution of his standing. He's got the money to hang in there for as long as he wants to, if he wants to. I can't think that any of the other candidates, what I think is going to happen is that this is going to be all about Trump and Carson, actually. And the questioning
not
of Trump
and Bush,
and not Bush. I mean, Bush is going to have to assert himself if he wants to get any play in this. I think Kasich needs to emerge too, if and Christie too. Those guys are sort of all hanging back. Rubio is the leading establishment so-called candidate. It'd be nice if he performed well too.
Is this the right moment for him to break? Everyone talks about how Rubio keeps stalling his breakout moment. Mm-hmm. Is this that moment, or do we still have to wait?
I don't think Rubio's looking for a breakout moment. He's looking for steady, gradual gains, and he's succeeded in that. So, look, there are 11 Republican debates, so this is only the third one, so he has lots of time to do that. Ben Carson is worth watching because his poll numbers have gone up. If he had a dazzling debate performance, he could consolidate some of those gains. He's running a very unusual campaign. He's running not on some record or not on his proposals. He's running because he's Ben Carson, this celebrated brain surgeon who has written a lot of books and is well-known around the country. But he has a chance to really lock in some voters.
Well, going back to Jack Kemp in the book, how much of your writing this book right now was written as an antidote to the current tone of conservative politics during the age of Trump?
A lot. We were hoping that this book would inspire or maybe embarrass current day politicians, actually of both parties, to understand that there was a better way to go than they are now. I mean, what Washington is a mud fight constantly between the two parties and within the Republican Party in particular, and nothing is getting done. The public is furious with Washington. They want to shake things up. And Jack Kemp set an example of how to shake things up, not with insults or pitting one group against another, but with ideas, dramatic ideas to make the country better, make the economy work for ordinary people.
Well, before we go, I just want to ask you something that relates to Jack Kemp and also relates to both of you as the Beltway boys. When Kemp got elected, he spent most of his time in Washington. He was a pretty adept political power broker. He was probably as much of a Washington guy as you could imagine. You two are Fox News, the Beltway boys, and truthfully, it doesn't get much more Beltway than you. Does it bother you that in this day and age, inside the Beltway, quote unquote, inside the Beltway, has become something of an epithet?
Doesn't bother me at all. I mean, I grew up inside the Beltway before there was a Beltway. So, and if somebody wants to call me an establishment hack, well, that's up to them. That's fine. But I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I think the Weekly Standard magazine, which is a conservative magazine, is going to have a great deal of influence on the Republican Party and how it goes. And that's one of the reasons we wrote about it, or at least I was eager in writing about Jack Kemp. And that is because the Kemp idea of a bigger Republican Party that brings in immigrant groups and African Americans and so on is even more critical now than before. The white vote is shrinking. Republicans have to grab some of this vote or they'll be a losing party.
Yeah, it's a survival thing.
Yeah, and I think it's important what happens at the state level, but it is very important what happens at the national level. If we, national policy has a great deal to do with whether we're a strong country economically, whether we're a strong country internationally. And, you just can't have the government as inept and as fractious as it is now and have a successful country. I mean, China and Russia look at us and look at the political conflict in the United States and see a weakening America. Obama's part of it, but the inability to get anything done on a bipartisan basis is also contributing to the image of weakness of the country.
Well, hopefully we'll get back to a little bit of the politics of Jack Kemp in this next election. The book is called Jack Kemp, the Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Well, that's the show, folks. And once again, thank you to Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki for coming on the podcast to talk about their new book. If you enjoyed the conversation on this episode, then check out their book, Jack Kemp, The Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. I'll post an Amazon link for the book in the show notes for this episode, as well as on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Or if you prefer the audio version of their book, narrated by Mort and Fred themselves, then you can download the audiobook for free thanks to that special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for your free 30-day trial and your free audiobook. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. And don't forget to go on our website or click on the survey link in the show notes to take that listener questionnaire for me. I really want to get a feel for who our audience is, and if you just take a minute to fill that out, that'll be a huge help to me. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends and suggest that they subscribe. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my guests on the show. This week, I'm giving away a signed copy of Jack Kemp, The Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America, by my guests today, Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki. To be entered to win, just go on your Facebook page or Twitter and tell your friends about Kick-Ass Politics. Now, be sure to include an iTunes link where they can go to the show. And as I said before, if you promote the show on both Facebook and Twitter, you'll double your chances of winning an autographed copy of my book of the week. In fact, you'll be entered to win every time that you recommend us to your friends on social media. So be sure to tag us when you do so. You can tag us on Twitter at KA Politics, or our Facebook page is just Kickass Politics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. And if you watch the debate tonight, I'll be live tweeting throughout the whole thing, so follow me on Twitter at KA Politics. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass Politics.